Good morning, and welcome. My name is Phil Runyon, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's speaker, Adar Cohen. Please join me in thanking the Merry Pipers who provided music for us today. We also thank today's sponsors, People's United Bank and RBC Wealth Management. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. Today's talk will be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are also recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. This year, selected Lyceum programs will be broadcast on Saturday night at 10 p.m. starting in late July. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, the speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will collect your questions toward the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through the door to your left. There you'll have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. In your pew, you will also find a green card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list and/or email list. You can either mail the green card to us or drop it in one of the glass bowls. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum primarily is supported through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Adar Cohen. Adar largely grew up right here in Peterborough, but he's covered a lot of additional territory since those early years. He studied first at Wheaton College, then completed his doctorate in international peace studies at the University of Dublin, Trinity College. It was in Northern Ireland that Adar also trained as a mediator and learned the dispute resolution skills that he's taken to Chicago and other communities and to the Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies Department at DePaul University, where Adar has been an award-winning faculty member. Adar has investigated and reported on human rights abuses at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp, and then as an official guest of the King of Bhutan, he's designed courses and taught in the first college in that Himalayan kingdom. Adar also co-founded the Civic Leadership Foundation that's helped thousands of at-risk and gang-involved youth become leaders in their communities. We'll hear more about that today. And in the process of everything else, Adar has managed to co-author the book, Jimmy Lee and James, Two Lives, Two Deaths, and the Movement That Changed America, the story of how the killing of two civil rights activists inspired the Selma to Montgomery marches that led to the 1965 Voting Rights Act. There's even more than that, but I'm afraid it would just depress the rest of us. So I'll leave it at that and say, welcome, Adar Cohen.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all. Thanks, Phil, for that generous, depressing introduction. I also want to thank the Monadnock Lyceum Committee for organizing this wonderful tradition, and Mary Valier Kaplan in particular for all of the work she does to make this happen, soup to nuts. A thanks to New Hampshire Public Radio for broadcasting the podcast, and most of all, for all of you for being here today. Thank you. Willie Nell Avery is 27 years old. She's an insurance agent. She's standing in her town center, watching police car after police car pull up to the courthouse until there are 10. And inside the back seat of each police car is a rod. The rod is stretched across the back seat, and on the rod hang dozens of police uniforms, more than she can count. She's in Marion, Alabama. It's February 18th, 1965, and she's involved in a highly coordinated, strategic, and strictly nonviolent campaign to earn the right to vote for African Americans. During this time, police monitor activists, they monitor meetings, there are beatings, arrests. Peaceful activists are jailed, subjected to humiliation and great violence. So when Willie Nell Avery sees these police cars and when she sees the uniforms hanging on these rods in each back seat, she knows that these police uniforms are not for police officers. They're for white posse men who will show up that night and volunteer to attack black protesters. No need for white robes and hoods when your police department will deputize you for the evening, even bring you a uniform. But still, after watching all those cars come into her small town, she and her husband don't change their plans. They'll attend that evening's meeting, even though just 2 weeks ago, Willie Nell Avery was struck hard across the chest by a billy club. A police officer sent her to the ground hard. Still feeling those bruises, she'll open the meeting that night with song. She and her husband, as usual, will bring their small children to a relative's house to spend the night. And when she tucks them in there, before leaving, she's honest with them. She says, "We might not come home tonight." 50 years later, I sat across Willie Nell Avery in a small diner in Marion, Alabama, and I asked her, "How could you do it?" And without much emotion, frankly, she told me, "It really didn't matter to me very much at that time whether I lived or whether I didn't. I was half dead anyway. So I had made up my mind I would keep struggling, I'd keep fighting until I had my freedom." A few weeks after that meeting that Willie Nell and her husband attend, 50 million Americans are sitting in their living rooms on the couch watching TV, and they're watching the film Judgment at Nuremberg, which is the film that famously grapples with Nazism and the legacy of the Holocaust. Brutal war criminal Nazis are being held to account. And in the middle of that program, in the middle of that film, ABC makes the decision to cut away, in the middle of the movie, to show footage from earlier that day of Alabama state troopers and white citizens brutally attacking nonviolent marchers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. These marchers had undertaken a march, a nonviolent march from Selma to Montgomery to dramatize their grievances with voter suppression. And they're attacked on that bridge by state troopers who swing clubs, who trample protesters from horseback, fire tear gas. They swing clubs with all their might, and when protesters are lying motionless on the ground, the footage shows 50 million Americans that these state troopers are going to keep swinging. And for some Americans watching this, it's too much. It's finally too much. With thousands of others, Willie Nell Avery kept fighting. She kept pushing. And 5 months after the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the Voting Rights Act is passed, enforcing the right to vote for African Americans. That basic constitutional right. But since 2008, states across the country are adopting measures that deliberately make it harder for Americans to vote. African Americans, the elderly, students, people with disabilities are all targeted by cuts to early voting, strict, archaic voter ID laws, and purges of voting rolls. We know that voting is critical to democracy. But freedom is about more than access to the ballot. It's about belonging, basic protections, equality before the law. So why could Willie Nell Avery, in 1965, describe herself as half dead? That was certainly about not being able to vote. But it was about more than that. It was about being systematically and cruelly excluded from society. And that exclusion made other harms, other exploitations possible. Which brings us to today and to our topic of violence in Chicago. And about how some young people are finding ways to lift themselves up and to lift others up in the process. They are, in essence, striving to become a part of our democracy, to belong, to help. And they do this even as our systems continue to exclude them, to overlook them, to incarcerate them. In the last 30 years, the U.S. has seen more than a 500% increase in its prison population. That has disproportionately affected people of color. According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, 1 in 3 black males born today in the U.S. is expected to go to jail or prison in his lifetime. 1 in 3. In spite of this, remarkable youth of color are finding ways to look after one another. And I think their stories can tell us a lot about our country's struggle with violence, poverty, trauma. I think their stories can tell us a lot and help us to consider the roles that education, housing, employment, the justice system, mental health, the roles that all of those play in addressing these issues. But most of all, I hope their stories can cause us all to ask more questions, honest questions, questions from the heart. Like, who are we responsible for? How large is that circle? Is it possible to empower someone? How can you do that? And how accessible is our democracy? How accessible do we want it to be? A group of teenagers sits in a circle of chairs. They're in a neighborhood called Englewood, a remarkably resilient, creative community in Chicago that is also deeply scarred by violence and poverty. And when the young women and men first joined this group, they sat way back in their chairs, arms folded, hats real low, maybe their hood up, anything they could do to keep that well-intentioned adult in the room at a safe distance. But this day, they lean forward. It's loud in the room. Their voices overlap. Without there being a sense of anyone being interrupted, they're sharing stories, they're comparing experiences. One describes her life at home. This teenage girl's mom battles with addiction, and the friends who come and go in the apartment don't feel so trustworthy. This teenager takes care of 2 younger siblings, and most weeks, she pays more of the bills than her mom is able to. All in the group nod their heads in recognition. Another chimes in about taking care of siblings. They drive you crazy inside the apartment, but you can't take them outside, down the block, on account of the shooting. And all of them nod their heads in recognition. And all of them, at night, for as long as they can remember, have fallen asleep to the sound of gunfire. In 2016, Chicago saw 762 deaths to gun violence. That was more that year than New York and LA combined. 75% of those murdered were African American, and 51% were younger than 25 years old. But this group of teenagers doesn't stop at commiserating. They continue to pull on this thread, this theme of neighborhood safety, and they do research. They interview neighbors. They hold public meetings, and eventually they narrow their focus to a particular corner in the neighborhood. This is a corner that has a corner store, and neighbors need to access food and other staples at this corner store, but it's not safe there. Gang members are always present. Drug transactions almost every hour of the day. What could they do, they ask themselves, about this corner? They debate, they brainstorm, they come up with ideas, they disagree, sometimes bitterly, they work through it, and finally they form a plan. This is what they're going to do. They're going to paint the sidewalk around that corner. And they're going to paint it with butterflies, flowers, hearts. It's going to be pink and purple. And their logic here, maybe you're after it already, is that gang members won't be so keen to stand and represent themselves on a sidewalk painted as such. So they let community members know what they're planning to do. They let the police know what they're planning to do, because they'll get scooped up before the first heart is finished. If they don't, they let them know. The police say, it sounds great. And they do it. And they've never been so alive. And the community laughs and breathes a sigh of relief it hasn't breathed in a while. Now, let's make no mistake. They didn't move the needle on violence in Chicago. Probably not even in Englewood, their neighborhood. At best, they may have displaced the gang for a short while. But that wasn't really the point. The project changed the way they thought about themselves, changed what they thought of themselves as being capable of. It also critically changed the way their community, neighbors, thought of them. The group discovered a sense of agency. And this was profound for a group that just a few weeks earlier was discussing its lack of agency. How all of them, at a young age, back when they were still attending school, had faced the same impossible decision. They had to get from their apartment to school and back safely, in one piece. To do that, you couldn't travel alone. So when they chose to walk with this group of kids or that group of kids, there it was. They had joined a gang. They were gang members now. So when we hear about gang violence and a mayor in any city talks tough about cracking down, zero tolerance on gang members, we should ask ourselves who exactly we're talking about. Who are we cracking down on? Is it the skinny kid with thick glasses who really loves to read Harry Potter, who has seen his friend get shot, who deals daily with a mother in the throes of addiction, who found solace and normalcy at his school, which was just permanently closed, who has the choice of providing for his siblings and not providing for them, who carries someone else's marijuana and sells it in order to buy those siblings' food, who has sometimes lived in a cell. Who are we cracking down on? And are we ready to be as vigilant on behalf of his education, his career prospects, his health, his participation in our democracy? Schools must be a cornerstone of any effort to address these issues, troubled as they may be, underfunded, overcrowded, outdated. They're still the place where we have a chance of engaging young people before they disengage, before they are irreversibly excluded from economic opportunity. In Chicago, at least, schools are much more than a place to get your education. It's where you can access food if you don't have any. It's where you can stay warm on dangerously cold days. It's where you can go to escape the violence. So when students stop coming to school, when we lose that last connection to them, it becomes much harder to reach them, it becomes much harder to help them to become the adults their neighborhoods really need. In Englewood, where these kids painted the sidewalk, 6 schools were closed in 2013. Another 5 are in the process of closing. A young man walks slowly around the inside of a seated circle of his peers. He's holding in his hands like a rare artifact, a piece of paper, and he stops in front of each person's face, holds that piece of paper for a nice long while. He's holding a check, a paycheck. It's not for very much, but it has his name on it, and he wants everyone in the group to see his name printed on the check. All of his peers have been working from a young age, but no one's ever held an actual paycheck with their name on it. So we talked about the importance of schools. I was once a part of designing and overseeing a program that was exclusively for kids who were no longer in school, who had lost that connection. They were also multiply arrested and gang affiliated. That was the criteria to enter this program. We were that serious about reaching kids who were at the highest risk of violence. And it was in that program that this young man walked around the circle, took the time, and held up his check in front of each young man's face. At first, they react. They're stunned a little bit. So they tease him. Oh, you're a chump, working so hard for so little money. And they'll fire you any day. But how'd you do it? How'd you get the job? They're more than a little curious. And he explains, well, there's what we've been talking about in the group here. It's really got me thinking. And I heard about this place called the Cheesecake Factory. What? He explains the Cheesecake Factory to them. And he said, my auntie agreed to lend me her car. They were hiring. I drove all the way out to Schaumburg, which he characterized as the distant Wild West. In fact, it's about 20 miles northwest suburb from Chicago. He drove all the way out there and he told the hiring manager about the program. He shared with the hiring manager his own personal definitions that he had developed for responsibility and accountability. Big hit with the hiring manager. Hired on the spot. He got the job. Amazing, right? It gets better. It gets better. After plenty of teasing from his crew, one of his buddies approaches him, and it's clear this guy is serious about also trying to get a job at the Cheesecake Factory. They discuss it, borrow Auntie's car, drive out to Schaumburg again, and this guy gets hired. And then another, and another, and another, until, yes, all of them are working at the Cheesecake Factory. And if you ask them about it, they will tell you, oh, the Cheesecake Factory? We run that place by now. But Auntie, as impressed as she is, doesn't have much use of her car anymore on account of all of these trips. But before I tell you what happens next, remember, this group, when the program started, most of them wouldn't speak to each other, wouldn't make eye contact with one another, because they were from rival groups. That was against the code. Most of these kids were still on some kind of correctional control. What happens next is they all pool their limited resources and they buy a minivan. It's dilapidated. It's a horrible looking minivan, but there's enough seats in it to drive the lot of them back and forth to Schaumburg for shifts at the Cheesecake Factory. We run that place by now. I want to tell you that the pride in their smiles and a relief one could see in their eyes is something that I can't forget. It's noteworthy that these kids had to leave their neighborhood to find a part-time job. How'd their neighborhood become the kind of place where a teenager can't get a part-time job? Thinking about their commute, what they saw on the way from Chicago to Schaumburg can tell us a lot about how their neighborhood got to be the way it is. We'd have to go into history. We don't have time today to talk about 250 years of slavery, emancipation, Reconstruction, 90 years of Jim Crow, 60 years of separate but equal, the great migration spanning most of the 20th century in which African Americans flee the South, heading northward, more than 6 million of them to escape lynchings, the theft of their land without recourse, no equality before the law. So it was the great-grandparents and the great-great-grandparents of the Cheesecake Factory boys who fled the South, looking for a better life, maybe just looking to survive. What did they find when they got to Chicago, when they tried to make a home for themselves? Chicago, we know, is one of the most segregated cities in the country, and its history of housing discrimination tells us a lot about the violence and poverty we see today. Restrictive covenants were used to enforce racial segregation. Whites used violence and intimidation to keep blacks out of their neighborhoods, but even larger forces were at work to police the segregation, a system of redlining, rated neighborhoods on a scale of A to D. White neighborhoods got an A, colored green. It was a green light for investment. Mortgages issued without a problem, but black neighborhoods, D, colored red on the real estate maps. No investment, no mortgages. So even a middle-class family with steady, reliable income just could not get a house, could not make a home. So just about the only way throughout the 1960s on the south side of Chicago for a black family to have a home was to buy one on contract, which really wasn't to buy one at all. This was a predatory scheme where people sold homes to African Americans. They paid a down payment, made monthly payments, were responsible for all upkeep and repairs, but faced fluctuating interest rates and weird sudden charges, and would be routinely evicted for being a day late on the rent or the payment, or for no good reason at all, forfeiting not just all the monthly payments, but the down payment as well. And in comes the next black family. And these properties were churned over and over, yielding vast stretches of neglected properties that we still see in Chicago today. And this cycle, one black family in, family by family, block by block, South Side of Chicago dives into a generational poverty it still hasn't recovered from. So when we ask, why are certain parts of Chicago so violent? This cracks the case. There's no mystery here. Those violent neighborhoods in Chicago are the redlined neighborhoods. This is where that predatory scheming took place. I picture the Cheesecake Factory boys rolling through these neighborhoods in their dilapidated van, past houses with boarded up windows, the same houses their forebears had tried to own, driving past liquor stores, check cashing stores, through real estate boundaries that were once policed as brutally as the gang boundaries these kids know so well. When I picture them making this drive, leaving the city where their parents and grandparents had tried to make a home in Chicago, I wonder what they talked about in the van. I wonder what that drive was like. So it's a Friday night in Chicago. It's dusk. In a public park, a group of kids socialize, talking about the week, getting ready for the weekend. It's young kids, older kids, girlfriends, boyfriends. And suddenly a car pulls up slowly, and from inside the car, someone fires a gun several times outside, out the window. And the crowd, some hit the ground immediately. They've been there before, they know what to do. Some run, some scream, some are silent. And I learned about this incident from a young man who was there that night and who was in one of the programs that I'll tell you more about later. And he told me about this incident. He also recognized the shooter. He knew who it was. So after the shooting, all that night, Friday night, all Saturday, this young man's family and friends pressed him to retaliate. This wasn't an attempt to shoot anyone. No one was shot. This was a message. Message in an ongoing back and forth between gangs. But this young man not only says, no, it's not what I'm going to do, he convinces the young men his age to stand down. He says, I'm going to handle this. And on Sunday, he goes out into the city and he tracks down the shooter. He finds him. He confronts him. And he says the words, we need to talk. And they talk. And it's not a brief conversation. And the young man shares what he's been talking about in this program. They talk about ethics. He says there were young kids there that night. A lot of kids not involved with the gang. This is unacceptable. And remarkably, the shooter agrees, apologizes, and they shake on a truce. We're not going to do this sort of thing anymore. This is remarkable. It ends well, in a sense, but let's not forget the crowd of kids who know how to hit the ground, who've run screaming at the sound of gunfire before. This is trauma. This is PTSD. And the research is clear that this kind of toxic stress, these adverse childhood experiences, take a heavy toll on a young person, and really throughout the rest of their lives. How did we get here, that kids socializing in a public park are terrorized by gunfire? We considered housing and this history of exploitation around housing. There's another component of Chicago's history that's relevant here, and it's the experiment with public housing. In the 1950s, throughout the 50s, in Chicago, public housing towers are developed, massive public housing projects, housing more than 15,000 residents. And most would agree that this was an earnest attempt at the time to address urban poverty. The towers were affordable, close to the lake, modern, they were fireproof. But it didn't work out. Conditions in the towers deteriorated rapidly. They were underfunded and mismanaged, but the bigger issue was that we know now it's not a good strategy to isolate poverty. To help people develop a pathway out of poverty, integration is better than isolation. Police feared entering these towers, these campuses, and when they did, they entered as though in combat mode. It was a very dangerous, difficult place to grow up. And by 2011, the last of these towers is demolished. And now here are these 15,000 residents homeless, spreading throughout the city to try to find a way to make it, find a place to live. And what they find are gangs battling for turf in the wake of these closures, and the Chicago Police Department cracking down with some really aggressive policing and locking up the heads of a lot of the larger street gangs, and locking them up for life, which many saw on the face of it to be something good for public safety. Got to do something about these gangs, right? The trouble is, these gang leaders are also fathers and sons and brothers. They're also pillars in their community. They're actually holding a lot of the violence in check, which we didn't know before all of them went into prison for life. And we entered a new era of chaotic, block-by-block gunfire. Any youngster in the gang now was unchecked. There was no more protocol on when things could erupt into gunfire. No more gang truces that these leaders often held in place. So now, one slight, one wrong look, and it goes to gunshots immediately, and we're still experiencing that today. We're also still asking the question, what about the police? Can't the police rein this in? The Chicago Police Department has a troubled history in Chicago, but makes reforms, is using data, is engaging in some creative partnerships with agencies and experts. But most Chicagoans, particularly African Americans, are still fearful and distrustful, and not without cause. In 2014, Laquan McDonald, 17 years old, he's been in foster care and the juvenile justice system since the age of 3. He has a PTSD diagnosis. He's in the midst of a mental health crisis. He's walking down the busy street, behaving erratically. And he's walking away from the group of officers when one, who had arrived 6 seconds prior, fires his gun strikes Laquan in the back. He hits the ground, and that officer fires 15 shots in 15 seconds, ending Laquan McDonald's life. Police are dishonest about the incident. There's the dash cam footage. Contributing to fear and distrust of police in Chicago. So when we think about the young man who went out and found that shooter and said, we need to talk, it's pretty remarkable. We can imagine now why he didn't think to just call the police, which is maybe what many of us here might have done. That was the last option on his list. He was used to retaliating, to getting right back out there and protecting his community, protecting his siblings, his friends, sending the same message back. But this time he didn't want to. But he still wanted to act. How does a young person who experiences this kind of trauma become this kind of civic actor? In a city where in 2017 there was a shooting at a rate of every other hour, how does this young man become a peacekeeper? To continue asking these questions, I want to tell you about another student of mine. This is a young man named Miguel. And I once visited Miguel in his high school, and I passed 15 armed security personnel on my way from the metal detectors to his classroom to meet with him. They weren't wearing police uniforms. They were a private security firm hired by the state, which had taken over this district. So dysfunctional and violent was this school. The atmosphere in the building, around the building, was tense all the time. Gangs operated inside and outside the school. And here's Miguel, a brilliant student who isn't terribly motivated by what his teachers have to offer him, trying to figure out a way to make it through. And the more he discusses what's important to him with his peers, the more he begins to identify this issue of there not really being some relevant, safe, reliable activity for him to engage in after school. This is his concern, and he thinks that many of his peers share that he's not an athlete. He's not interested in the marching band. There isn't much else. His passion, he talks about in the program with me, is music production, music mixing. And so months later, he develops his own venture. It's a mobile music production studio. With less than $100 that he raises himself, he creates a music mixing setup that he can open up and take down in any classroom in the building after school. He calls it A Star Is Born. It's not named after the film some of you will recognize. It's named after the Jay-Z song others of you will recognize. And several months after that, I walk into this school and find 40 of his peers crammed into a classroom, craning their necks, craning their ears to listen to what he's got to say, to see if they can learn something from him about music production. Some of these guys in the room are the same ones that were recruiting him outside school. Now he's recruited them. In each of the cases I've told you about, these young people had a few things in common. They had an environment that adults had carved out for them and protected for them, where they could belong, where they could be accepted, and where they could be in dialogue with one another. They all had an opportunity to devise and implement a project for their community. And they all had a chance to identify and define skills that they were using in doing those things, and to think together about how those skills could help them to do what they would like to do in their lives. And this is what Civic Leadership Foundation does. This is what my organization does. We try to create those environments. I was involved in co-founding the organization with Howard Rossman and David Elias, and we set out to create those conditions in which young people could experience that kind of transformation by themselves, for themselves. We Do it by partnering with schools in neighborhoods that are affected by violence and poverty to teach young people critical, lifelong leadership skills that can prepare them to be successful in college, in their careers, and to engage positively in their neighborhoods. We've done this in a lot of settings. Juvenile justice system, reaching out on the street, storefront, youth development agencies, churches. But we're doing it exclusively in schools now with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders because we've learned that the earlier we intervene, the earlier we start, the better. We talked about how critical schools are to interrupting this cycle. 1 in 3 black males born today in the U.S. expected to go to jail or prison in their lifetime. We think that it's not enough, though, to keep young people in school. That won't be enough to assure a successful future. It won't brace them well enough for what's waiting for them outside of school. So we think that this project learning, this engaging, hands-on in the community, is a way to light a fire in them, to inspire them, to set goals, run a meeting, speak publicly, work through disagreement, persuade others to join you. At first, no one came to Miguel's music studio. He had to recalibrate, he had to try again. He got it, but he had an opportunity to try and fail and try again. Empowering young people, I want to be clear, is not a Chicago issue. It's not an urban issue. This is about the future of our democracy. It's about what kind of country we want to be. More than ever before, we need young people to feel connected, to feel responsible for their democracy. This kind of learning out in the community that is rooted in one's passions, one's concerns, we think that that's a really great way to prepare a young person for individual success, but to also prime them for community engagement later in life. And that's important on the south side of Chicago, it's important in New Hampshire, and it was important in Marion, Alabama in 1965 when Willie Nell Avery decided that she wouldn't quit, she wouldn't give up, until she had the right to vote, not just for herself, but for her family members, for her neighbors, for her whole community, for Alabama, and for the whole country. When she showed up to vote at the voter registrar, they gave her literacy tests. She took them. They didn't grade them. They asked her how many bubbles are in a bar of soap. They humiliated her. She came back. She came back again and again so frequently that, as she shared with me, I think they knew the sound of my walk. They didn't look up when I came around the corner. She didn't quit. She didn't quit, and Miguel didn't quit. Miguel's in his final year of college now. He's about to become a journalist. The young man who single-handedly interrupted one cycle of violence in Chicago, who found a shooter and said, "We need to talk," he didn't give up. He tried to do what he thought was right. The Cheesecake Factory boys, who drove their beat-up minivan straight into the 21st century workplace. Who here doesn't want to be inside that van? Hear what they were talking about. The kids who painted the sidewalk outside that corner store. These are kids who aren't quitting. When I think of all that they've been through and what they've been able to accomplish, what courage. So wherever you are, if you're here today, if you're listening on the radio, please know that all around you there are young people whose educational and career trajectories depend on how engaged they are in considering them, in exploring them. How will you support them? I'm not asking, will you support them? I'm going straight to how. And standing here, actually, in my hometown, looking out and seeing so many of you who did that for me, I want to thank you all. I think you know who you are. But supporting young people, it only gets us halfway. We have to invite them in, but that's not our only challenge. Today, across the country, adults are working really hard to keep young people out of their democracy. I told you about Willie Nell Avery today and her work on behalf of voting rights because her struggle in the 1960s is very much connected with the struggles of youth on the south side of Chicago today. And one of the most glaring connections here is the connection around voter suppression. People are trying to make it harder for students and people of color and the elderly to vote. And it's a calculated strategy and it's working. They're having success with this. So while we reach out and around us to engage young people and to try to draw them toward their democracy, it's critical that at the same time we're vigilant about making sure that that democracy is accessible to them. This is a frightening and unpredictable time for our country. When I think of Willie Nell Avery taking that test at the voter registrar countless times, the humiliation of it, how many jelly beans are in this jar? When I think of her standing in her town center, watching police cars pull in with all those uniforms, and she knows so well what the billy club feels like when it strikes her body, I have to imagine she was afraid, uncertain, overwhelmed. Today, Willie Nell Avery is the voter registrar of Perry County, Alabama. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Adar.